Good morning. I'm Norman Gilliland, and today we're going to devote this hour of music to Puccini, and specifically to his opera La Boheme from 1896, which is going to be performed Friday, May 9th, and Sunday, May 11th at the Eline Hall, Marcus Center for the Performing Arts, and it's being produced by the Florentine Opera, and we have some fascinating guests here to fill us in and actually kind of guide us through the opera, because at the piano we have the conductor for the occasion, Joseph Rossigno. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And we also have one of the leads, you could almost say the lead, which playing the part of Mimi, which is Allison Cambridge. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And then the general director of the Florentine Opera, William Florescu, is becoming a regular.
It's a pleasure to be here again.
Good to have you back.
Thank you.
Always fascinating stuff that you come up with for these operas, the background and the music itself. And before we start tapping Joe for the excerpts from the piano, just a little bit of a setup for La Boheme. We still have a fairly young composer, Puccini, when he has this string of big hits, and this is one of them.
Right. It's one that sort of really sealed his fame and has become, I think, any company that does it is a marketing genius when they do La Boheme, because I think the story is universal and remains every component of the story, I think, someone can relate to, and I think that's why it works so well. And the combination of wonderful music and drama that goes with it, and some comedy as well, I think just makes it work wonderfully as a piece.
Yes, I guess I don't want to get into this question as to whether it's comedy or tragedy, because, as you say, it does have some comedy, but there's definitely undercurrent of regret and loss.
Well, absolutely, and the juxtaposition of comedy in the last act, when the four Bohemian guys are sort of fooling around, and then Mimi comes into the scene, and that's so much of what life's like. You think you're going along, everything's going well, things are light, and then tragedy hits, and I think that's why it is so real and is palpable in its feeling of being like what life is like.
Well, Allison, you're nodding there. You're nodding your agreement, and since you're playing the part of Mimi, who is the centerpiece of this drama, how do you make that character come across? I mean, she goes through some changes.
She does. I think, as Bill said, this is a story that I think everybody can relate to. It's a story of young love, pure love, maybe a first love. I think Mimi and Rodolfo have perhaps had boyfriends, girlfriends, lovers in the past, but this is the first time they've experienced real, pure, deep love. And I think watching their journey is really interesting, their relationship. And of course, yes, the tragedy is that Mimi is sick. And so you see how Mimi and Rodolfo want to continue their relationship despite some personal problems that they have and her illness. They want to stick it out to the bitter end together. It just really speaks to the power of love. And also, not just between Mimi and Rodolfo, but the love that exists within the friendships between everybody.
It really is a lot about friendship, isn't
yes.
it? And self-sacrifice for
exactly.
the sake of this friendship.
And all of the friends sacrifice things to help out Rodolfo and Mimi in their plight.
We have to say that this is sort of the quintessential starving artist story. I mean, literally set in a garret, at least in some of the stagings of it. This is Paris, circa 1830. And let's see, we have a poet, of course, and Rodolfo. Mimi is she's the only one with an ostensibly practical trade here. Unfortunately, she's too
seamstress
ill
and
to
makes fake
it.
Flowers.
We have a philosopher among these friends and a painter. I mean,
and Chouinard, the musician.
Yeah, how broke can you be as a group
right.
of friends?
Right.
Which means that, of course, they have to rely upon each other, and it makes for some great music too.
One of the things I think is great about the friendship thing, because when I was in college, I remember this. You have nothing and you think, if I ever get any money, I'm going to do something really practical with it. Then money comes in and you decide to blow it all at once, which is just so much the way we were when we were that age. And that's why I think it resonates
we
so well.
We see that in this opera, don't we?
Absolutely.
They finally get some money from a sort of a quirky source and
right.
Let's go out. But they still have to do battle with the landlord, don't
absolutely.
They, about
yeah.
that rent.
Yeah.
I have a question, Maestro, mm-hmm. about overtures. There was a certain point at which they almost seemed to have fallen out of fashion.
Yes. None of Puccini's operas have overtures. Closest maybe to Rondot. It has it's not quite an overture, but it has quite a bit of orchestra-only music before it really gets started, along with the mandarin, you know, in the middle of it. Richard Strauss pretty much got rid of the overture. Broadway sort of brought it back.
Interesting, I hadn't thought of that.
Funny story about this particular opera and the overture. It was the opening of my first season in 79-80 with the opera company in Providence, Rhode Island. And the regular critic, for some reason, was either ill or wasn't there. They sent this lady, who was the fashion reporter, and she criticized me for playing the national anthem instead of the overture, because it was the first opera of the season.
Then there was a common practice.
And I was like shocked. I said, "What is she getting this confused with Butterfly?"
And right.
I finally met her like 10 days later, and I said, "Do you realize that there is no overture in La Boheme? I didn't cut the overture." She says, "Oh, I know. Everybody asked me about it when I got back."
but of course, as you say, you know, if it were Butterfly, then you would have
the
Star Spangled Banner
right.
in there to represent Lieutenant Pinkerton.
Yes.
That's right. But there is a symphonic prelude, right?
No,
there's
not
nothing
really.
At all. It goes straight into.
No, it's there's a brief. Maybe one short page that goes by in, 40 seconds, 30 seconds?
Does that make it any more difficult for you, Allison?
No. Well, I'm not in the opening
scene.
Well, that helps.
But what I think is great about it is that right from the start, the audience is brought into their world. There's not this sort of okay, everybody, get ready. We're about to see an opera and hear the story. It's like, hey, we're in this garret with these boys, and the music indicates that. It's fun and jovial. And
yeah, Madame Butterfly is a little bit more, has a few pages, maybe the one of the fastest is this. That's all you get in Salome, and then the robot starts singing. With this you get, you and that's it. And then they start singing. So it's to the point. The curtain goes right up, and they're working. But interestingly, just in that brief thing, we have already two important motives.
Representing?
We have the motive of the Bohemians. And we have the motive, I call it the motive of Marcello. And this repetition, he's painting, and that's his motive. Unlike almost any other opera of Puccini, each of the characters has a motive. And you know it is because when something happens involving them, that motive comes back. As I say, this is the first one is the Bohemians in general. This is... the next motive we hear is Marcello's. Then you have Rodolfo's motive. Then we have Colline's. Then we have Schaunard's. Then we have Mimi's. And And finally, we have Musetta's. So each one has a motive.
Much more compact than Wagner.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Right. I think I'm sure that did influence at least in this opera, that Wagnerian idea of having little motives for characters and for ideas influenced him. He also, for example, in the opening of Act Two, we hear the tune first sung in Act One, but the opening of Act Two is this. Now, if I take those exact same notes and play them slowly with a different rhythm, we get this. And it's Christmas Eve, uh-huh. And it's a little Christmas carol that he hides
really?
into the opera.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Another thing that, unfortunately, this I kind of found, but something that I remember as a teenager hearing Leonard Bernstein say on TV, and it's really quite amazing, how in Act Three he takes a little motive when Rodolfo is telling Marcello that, oh, Mimì is just a flirt. Mimì è una civetta. The Italians use the word screech owl to mean flirt.
How poetic.
And by changing only one note, he makes this little tune tragic. In van nascondo, he says, I'm just hiding the reality that Mimì is dying, and I can't do it. I have no money to help her.
Interesting.
So Puccini is just great at. We know that. I mean, that Richard Strauss was good at this too, at hiding little things and making puns and, uh-huh. and things in the music. But so was Puccini. And actually, I find the two composers, other than the fact that one was German and one was Italian, to have a great deal in common.
Oh, quite contemporary too. Strauss just a few years younger than Puccini.
Exactly.
Well, this is an opera that... Well, I don't know whether at what point you start calling it, you know, realism, but it really has this mix of emotions that, and it seems to me it can turn on a dime mm-hmm. from, you know, almost like that theme
right.
from comedy to tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Well, he, unlike, for example, both Leoncavallo and to some extent Giordano and some of the other Verismo composers, Puccini never liked to dwell on the underbelly of humanity. I think the only real, all of this Verismo school came out of a French school of literature called Tranche de Vie, you know, slice of life. And the only real kind of down and dirty thing I think that Puccini ever wrote was Tabarro. Yeah. Tosca has the second act.
I was going to say, Tosca is a little there.
In the second act, it gets, it's kind of lightened by things in Act One. He always puts a little comedy into it, like the sacristan, or here Benoit, Chindor, or the whole second act is comic. And I think if you look at the opera that Leoncavallo wrote on the same subject, it's much closer to the original novella of Murci than Puccini's.
They started working on this opera at the same time, didn't they?
Right.
Without knowing Leoncavallo and Puccini.
Right.
Leoncavallo actually says, I mean, he wanted to sue Puccini because he basically gave him
the story.
Started first, but Puccini got it out in the public first.
Right.
And as a result, he was a little bit bitter
right. And in
it.
Fact, they were never friends again.
Yeah. Well, but Leoncavallo's, I mean, he got his opera out there, but it never amounted to much, did it?
Well,
it's not a bad piece.
It's
actually.
Not a bad piece at all. It's hard to say. For example, when Rossini wrote The Barber of Seville, one of the most famous operas in the repertoire at that time was The Barber of Seville by Paisiello. And he did not call it The Barber of Seville because, he didn't want to make even more enemies than necessary, so he called it Alma Viva.
But nobody was fooled.
And well, but within literally within 20 years, it kind of blew Paisiello's opera right out of the water. And
posterity tends to
judge,
divide those. I mean, decide those things. So it's
right. And and the same with this Bohème. I mean, you know, it was a huge hit.
It went international very quickly, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he was already Manon Lescaut really had launched him in a really big way. And
that's let's say same librettist, right?
I think so.
Jocosa,
yes.
Ilika, right. Colorful character in his own right. He had you'll always see him with one side of his face turned toward the camera because one of his ears was lopped off in a sword fight over a woman. So these people lived some of the stories that they were writing. does Bohème start, I almost get this impression that it starts with this, what's sometimes called the happy peasants we scene. I mean, even though these are all kind of starving artists, but they seem pretty cheerful. And that opening setup
absolutely.
Sounded like it too.
Both act one until... Act one is not sad. Act one is basically lighthearted and fun, and then becomes romantic with the entrance of Mimi and the scene with Rodolfo. And the second act is just all fun. Actually, it's quite amazing. In the third act, you can tell when the tragedy begins, and Puccini gives an indication that, I'll be honest, I've almost never heard a conductor respect. You go from a rather quick tempo to a tremendously slow tempo. And he writes, when Mimi's motive comes in the orchestra, her entrance, he writes, lento molto, very slow. And he indicates that 1/8 note of this new tempo should be the same speed as the previous half note. The whole measure.
So
it's a violently slower thing. But if you hear it, you hear like this. And most people, they go,
which is, I guess, more lyrical, but less dramatically effective.
Right. And I mean, and he, as I say, he puts in these instructions and he gives you the previous metronome. So it's, and he writes very slow as a tempo.
He wrote very theatrically. Yeah. That he was thinking about the theater of it.
And at this moment, the whole story shifts. It goes from basically a comedy to a tragedy.
Which he does actually back in Act One too. When as soon as Mimi comes in, really.
Yes, but not so much tragic. It goes from kind of a farce to a romance.
Right.
But here, and that's why I think we have the tune almost twice as slow as we hear it in Act One, because
she's languishing.
Yeah, exactly. She reveals the extent of her sickness and the whole tragedy.
And I think what's really interesting about that in terms of Act One and Act Two, you know, you say, oh, well, Mimi's with her entrance, you know, she's the tragic character. I think that's certainly as the actress, as the singer in the role, I think it's important not to play the tragedy up front because
you have nowhere to go.
You have nowhere to go. Yeah.
It's
kind
of like Lear being mad at the beginning.
And I think it's important, and, you know, we talked about this in rehearsal, I think it's important to show, yes, Mimi is sick, and okay, you give that hint of it, of course, in Act One. Mm-hmm. However, I think it's important to show that she does have some life and light to her, and that she is this, you know, beautiful thing that you can really understand why Rodolfo would fall in love with her at first sight.
So it's not pity that motivates him.
No, it's
really genuinely
attracted. It's like, wow. And then she opens up her soul to him, and she's the equivalent does the girl version of what the guys do. You see how they're having all this fun and getting along with each other despite their poverty. And Mimi's the same way. She's like, yeah, you know, I just sit at home and I make these flowers, but gosh, when that sun hits my face and I, you know, she's a happy person as well. She said, I'm tranquil and happy.
And that's what you lose, of course, by the time you get to Act Three.
Right, and it makes it that much more tragic if you, poignant, exactly, if you show all that in Act One.
When we were working on this, luckily it's not a long opera, so we've had some time to talk about these things. And Allison brought up a very good point, which I really hadn't honed in on too much, but I think makes the character that much more rich, and that is that Mimi, when she meets Rodolfo, the straight ahead way to play it is that Rodolfo is the one that's scheming and trying to make the romance happen. But Allison brings a very good point that Mimi's playing part of this as well, and she uses the situation, even her illness, she uses a little bit to her advantage in terms of And so I think it makes it much more the character that much more rich, and the contrast then in the last two acts becomes that much more poignant because she's more fleshed out as a complete person, which I think makes it much more interesting.
You know, apropos to that, back in 82, I did a Boheme in Pittsburgh, and the set was very interesting. You saw the stairway going up and going down on the side. And during the Benoit scene, you see Mimi going up the stairs and looking down. Mm-hmm. And then as the people leave, you see her walk down the other way, walk from her place down, look at Rodolfo, and then knock on the door. Yeah. So
makes her a little bit more involved in relationship.
Exactly.
What do we hear then, Joe, when we get to this first? What do we hear when we have the starving artists at the beginning?
Oh,
what does that sound
what
like?
I played. What I played. This is their
that's
motive.
That's it.
That's the motive of the Bohemians in general. Then with Chouinard's entrance, and I find it hysterical. Even Puccini in a letter pointed this out. It said, isn't it ironic that of these four, the only one who makes any money is the musician?
Says, yes,
imagine
yes.
how desperate the other three must be if the musician
he does it on kind of a quirk, though.
Yeah. Poisoning the parrot.
Yeah.
That's Chouinard's motive, and he comes in and he has wood for the fireplace and wine and bread and cheese and things to eat and salami and
he struck it rich.
Right, he struck it rich because he was trying to give music lessons to an Englishman and who paid him for these lessons.
Our set allows us to actually have Chouinard. Having done Chouinard, it's the hardest working aria that no one pays any attention to. So we were able, at least with this set, have him point it out a little
right.
more because he's like working his tail end off and nobody's paying any attention to him. It's tough.
So now you mentioned the parrot, Bill, and the premise was that he's what's supposed to be.
The premise was he has to keep playing himself until the parrot dies. Well, of course, the parrot is a very long-lived creature. I mean, parrots live 75, 80 years.
Yeah, right.
And the poor guy has to, play for 80 years without stopping. So he uses the word parsley.
Right.
And maybe parrots can't eat parsley. But he said
parsley's been poisoned.
Been poisoned. It's like Socrates taking the hemlock to kill him, and he takes the parsley. And when the guy's not looking, he's playing, and then he sticks a little parsley in the parrot's beak, and the parrot keels over. So he's made a lot of money because he was paid this pretty hefty salary to play for. He thought maybe 70 years, but it was more like
7 minutes.
7 minutes.
And there's a little bit of carpe diem that comes in here because is he the one who says, well, you know, eat it up, drink it up now because, you know, get it while you can?
Well, he says a little bit of
don't
that.
Eat all the food I
but
brought.
But don't eat.
We're going to dine out tonight.
Save it. And he says, okay, drink the wine here, but on Christmas Eve, we have to eat out. We have to. And he thought that he had enough money to pay for dinner for all of them, but of course, they start ordering all kinds of fancy things.
So they got to stick somebody with a bill.
And right. And roast venison and champagne. And so when the bill comes, they don't have anywhere near the amount of money to pay for this. But luckily, Musetta saves the day by giving it all to her date of the evening, Alcindoro. And in the original story, Alcindoro was a senator and a married person. And one of the reasons he's upset of being outside is that he didn't want to be recognized. He wanted a little private room with
Musetta's anything but discreet.
Right.
We'll get to her maybe a little bit later, but give us again this transition then between all this kind of merriment
even the opening of Act 3 is lighthearted. You have a wildly different, and I personally think this indication, which is rarely observed, is similar. He might have even gotten the idea from an indication in Act One of Tristan, where
it's kind of a little reminiscent, isn't it?
Where Courvenal, he writes the same thing. He wants in this case the quarter note equal to the previous dotted half note. And most people make the quarter note equal to the previous dotted quarter note, but and most people go, it's very, very different. And like this moment where we go from basically from comedy to tragedy, in the moment in Tristan, Courvenal is saying, come, meaning to Brangaena and to Isolde, come on, ladies, we're getting near port, and Tristan wants to see you. And Isolde says, give Herr Tristan my greetings, but he comes to see me. And so that much slower tempo is appropriate. And
the same thing happens then in Act One in that transition
right.
from the boys into the entrance of Mimi.
Right.
It's a big tempo change.
Absolutely.
It's dun, dun, dun. And then, you know, you hear the crash, boom, bang, and, you know, Colline se morto, ha, ha, ha. And then you get this big chord, and it's knock, 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 scoozy,
right.
and then the slow Mimi theme.
Yes, the first time you hear that theme is in the orchestra. Mm-hmm. You have, he says, I'm not inspired. Non sono in vena. I'm not in the vein. It doesn't mean the vein of your arm. It means that, you know, I'm not inspired. And then you hear this.
What's so interesting about that is it's obviously her theme, but there's a lightness and an optimism
yes,
to that.
Sure, absolutely.
Versus when you hear
also,
it in Act 3, it sounds much more tragic,
absolutely.
Even though it's a similar theme.
And he uses, you know, Puccini has this one trait that runs through all of his works. When he wants a melody, he writes a terrific one. He was a great tunesmith. And when he wanted something to seem like dialogue, he just keeps writing the same note over and over. So in this case, both Rodolfo and Mimi just keep repeating the same note. It's not a tune. It's era, scusi, una donna di grazia. Mise spente il lume.
That's interesting.
Just
yeah.
The same. And of course, one of the great examples of that is the from Offstage, Butterflies music, where you have a wonderful tune for measure, and then the next measure is just talking, just the same note over and over.
Which is better than just talking without anything at all.
Right.
Back this hour with three guests from the Florentine Opera of Milwaukee, which is putting on a production of Puccini's La Boheme. This Friday, May 9th at 7:30, and Sunday, May 11th at 2:30, Eline Hall, Marcus Center for the Performing Arts in Milwaukee. And my guests are the conductor for the occasion, Joseph Rossigno, who's at the piano demonstrating some of the themes and motifs and even some of the arias from the opera. And we have our one and only Mimi in the opera with us, and that's Allison Cambridge, and then also the general director of the Florentine Opera, Bill Thorescu. So now we have talked about this first encounter between Mimi and Rodolfo, and it does feature one of the most famous arias in all of opera.
Well, it features two. They go back to back. We have Rodolfo opening his heart to Mimi, and then as soon as that is over, Mimi does the same to Rodolfo. And the arias are Che gioia da manina of the tenor and Mi chiamano Mimi of the soprano. And his aria begins in that technique that I said earlier when he's almost talking. He just repeats the same note for two measures. Che gelida manina, se la lasci riscaldar. Now, after a brief while, though, it gets more and more tuneful, and finally we have this. It slowly evolves. And in a similar technique, we have her aria, which begins with her motive. And then she repeats again. She says, my story is short. And they're again repeating the same note, kind of Puccini's parlando. La storia mia è breve, a te la osseta ricam in casa fuori. But finally, like with Che gelida manina, he breaks in finally with a glorious melody for her. So the structure of the two arias are somewhat similar, and they both end not with a great climax, but rather simply, almost conversationally, he does. And she says, after she sings this beautiful aria, well, there's really nothing else I can say. Altro di me non le saprei narrare. Anything more about me, I don't know how to say. I don't know how to narrate.
Puccini knows how to write a build-up, I tell you.
That's true. This opera, in a way, is nothing but one big build-up, isn't it? You know, one thing that I think a lot of people, especially if they're not that familiar with opera, would like about this one is that There are not a lot of plot devices to keep up. Not a lot of disguises and kind of trying to keep track of terribly complicated relationships and deceptions and that kind of thing. This is a very pared down, straightforward, simple love story.
It may be the most concise opera in the whole literature. There isn't one wasted note. There isn't one extraneous moment. I mean, basically, with that story you told about some of the earlier attempts of Puccini, that was typical. Puccini's operas are not cut because there's no need. They're short. He never wrote anything that even went over 3 hours. Let alone, you know, usually it's like this opera here is a little less than 2 hours of music. So it's a very...
That's slender.
Yeah.
Slender as Mimi.
I think it's important, too. You know, in a lot of operas, even today, you can have sort of the suspension of disbelief to believe the characters. But I think, you know, when we talk about Verismo, however you want to describe it, this is so relatable that I think you have to have the people that can act and look the parts as well as sing them to make that happen. Particularly in the case of Allison and Noah and all of the cast, it's believable across the board, and I think that is so required in this piece because you have to believe it in every sense of the word because it
it's not a fantasy.
You really
do have to buy it on a kind of a level
like you
of
said,
realism.
It's not any sort of contrived or complicated storyline. It's a story about some friends and two people who fall in love. So you've got to believe it at that very basic
and Allison's done level. Allison's done both roles, Musetta and Mimi, so she brings an interesting...
As long as you've mentioned Musetta, you know, one of the most famous of arias is Musetta's Waltz, as it's usually called. And it seems to me, given the content, I mean, what she's singing about, it's so often done as just a kind of a sweet little thing that if you didn't know what she was singing, that she's talking about, I am desirable and people, you know, practically salivate over me when they see me go down the street, you would have no clue about this character.
Right.
I mean, she's Carmen
it's very,
plus.
It's very interesting. Back in 94, I conducted an album with a soprano who's now retired from the stage, but Diana Soviero, and it was called Verismo. It was all this kind of music, and we contrasted the two waltzes from the two bohems, Musetta's waltz from this, and Mimi has a little waltz from the Leoncavallo, where she sings about Musetta. She says, "Oh boy, all the guys are crazy about Musetta," you know, and. But this he uses this. It's really quite magical. It's a very slender number when she sings it. And then after the aria, the ensemble grows and grows and grows and finally into the really the most climactic moment of the opera, where you have and they're all singing high notes and then finally replete with cymbals. And like good composers, be they Beethoven or Brahms or in this case Puccini, he can take a simple little germ of an idea and expand it into something much bigger.
Well, that's kind of the basis for a great tune,
anyway,
is that simple idea expanded upon. So if you were to be singing Musetta in this production rather than the part of Mimi, Allison, how would you sing this part that's really all about being sultry?
Well, it's so interesting. As you were playing that, I was just listening. That aria really encompasses Musetta very well. It's very... it's actually very elegant. It's very... seductive in a calm way. It sort of says, It's as if somebody's standing in a room, and rather than sort of leaning forward and being like, look at me, it's sitting back and saying, isn't this a great sight? Don't you like what you're seeing? That's kind of her attitude, I think, and which is what makes her such a powerful character. But she has so much fire and spice, and it's like she can't contain it. And so at the end, you get that big da-da-da-da.
dun, dun, dun. It comes out.
Right. Yeah, I'm not totally cool. I do have a lot of fire in me, and I think it's really exemplified in that aria.
And the whole, you know, the whole aria is in response to the fact that she's tried the more direct female thing of being obvious and squawky, sitting right next to Marcello.
Yes.
Which has had an effect, but she can't see it.
Yes.
So then I think, to your point, becoming calm and seductive is her response to her perceived lack of success with getting
with all the Marcello. Histrionics. Yes.
So this aria, even though it's about, it's really, it seems like it's a monologue, but it's really to Marcello.
Yes.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And you want this.
And we've staged it in such a way that you see Marcello's response even as Musetta doesn't. And of course, it's sometimes overshadowed, but Mimi's counterpoint, not just musically, but dramatically, because she's just fallen in love with this guy, and she's like, oh my gosh, I feel sorry for this girl. I mean, and she's taking all this in. So it's a really fabulous counterpoint musically and dramatically that I think is just a genius piece of dramatic and musical writing.
And one of the most poignant things about this opera is that when these tunes come back at the end, in Mimi's dying scene, we hear first, for example, Schaunard's tune. Collina, after he sings his coat aria, says, each one of us is trying to do something to help this lady. You could leave them alone. And we hear instead of we have the same thing, but all of a sudden now it's slower and it has a sadness to it. And where in Acts 2 and 3, Musetta was sexy, vivacious, life of the party, she shows such tenderness in this last scene, and especially after Mimi's dead, no one still is. Only Schaunard is first aware that she has died.
Yeah, isn't that an interesting effect too?
Right.
Yeah, at the end.
And Musetta says this little prayer that is just so sweet.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, certainly plenty of transition there for her. Back with three of the principals involved in the upcoming productions of La Boheme by Puccini. The Florentine Opera Company of Milwaukee is producing it on Friday, May 9th at 7:30 and Sunday, May 11th at 2:30 at Eline Hall, Marcus Center for the Performing Arts in Milwaukee. And with us for the balance of this hour now, the conductor, Joseph Rossigno, who's also at the piano doing some illustrations from the opera, and also the part of Mimi, as played by Alison Cambridge. She is represented, and then the general director of the Florentine Opera for how many years now, Bill Florescu?
9 on May 1st.
That's a lot.
But who's counting?
That's right. You know, hearing so much of an opera played on the piano instead of by a full orchestra with the singers and all that, Joe, to me, especially at certain points, I hear harmonies that sound particularly modern. I mean, we're talking about 1896, the cusp of the 20th century, and a composer who would be writing for another 28 years, who seemed to me just got increasingly 20th century sounding. But what are some of the Puccini harmonies in this opera?
Well, I mean, there's a little dissonance. When Schaunard gets this horn and plays a note on it and goes, this is out of tune. This D is out of tune. Sure, because it's playing a D against an E flat. The other he writes that dissonance. But I think one of the most interesting things, Puccini has a signature ending. Not quite like Rachmaninoff, who ended most of his pieces, which apparently was Rachmaninoff, but he ends with a tune from the opera. Usually it's not the most famous tune. We first hear this ending tune very soft. And then, at the very end, Rodolfo just says, "What does this mean? This going here and there, staring at me like that." And we hear a half step.
Yes.
And the only thing you hear against that is Rodolfo almost sobbing the name Mimi, and it's very effective. He ends Manon Lescaut with a little quote from the dance master's music, representing her finery. He ends Tosca with a quote of E lucevano le stelle. He ends Butterfly with. And even in death, Alfano finished Turandot quoting the Aria Nessun Dorma. So that's pretty much almost all of his operas end with a tune from the show. And I like to think that tune represents what he feels is the main
really?
Crux of the story.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. I was just going to, I mean, this is slightly off topic, but I was just, when you were playing that, it reminded me of when I was a little kid. Actually, the first time I saw Bohème, and it got to the end, the first time that I listened to it, and I went, oh my gosh, wait, why do I know this tune? I know this tune so well. It's because I would sit and watch soap operas with my grandmother,
uh-huh.
and The Young and the Restless
uh-huh.
was her favorite soap opera, and that their theme song was based off of that. And of course, I didn't realize it until years uh-huh. later, and it was just so familiar to me. And uh-huh. I was like, oh my gosh.
TV did a lot of that.
Yes. But isn't that something, though?
Uh-huh.
And I don't know anybody, I mean, who will sit in an audience and get to that part and not feel something. Mm. It just gets to you. That's what was so amazing about Puccini. And then, of course, all these people steal and take these things and repurpose them.
Yes, that's what I find so intriguing is how you take somebody like Puccini writing in the really up till 1924 with Turandot, right. which, as you right. say, had to be finished by someone else, and how that got in kind of the into the bloodstream of then more popular mm-hmm. music as
oh, sure.
the 20th century progressed.
And even the stories, when you think about it, first Miss Saigon, which is Madame Butterfly, and,
right, right.
and Rent, which is Bohème.
Which is
uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I remember one of my first jobs, I had just gotten out of school, I was an assistant to a conductor named Laszlo Halas, who was one of the founder of the New York City Opera. And it was 1971, the Vietnam War was still happening, and he did a Madame Butterfly set in Vietnam. and during the Vietnam War. He said it in the war, and she didn't kill herself with a knife the way, you know, the Harakiri.
Yeah, right.
He had left a service revolver or something, and she had saved it, and she goes, went off into the wings, and you hear the shot. She shot herself.
Yes, which, of course, you adapted right. to the times right. and the
right.
place, sure,
yeah.
which is done all the time.
Now, of course, I think it would be a terrible cliche to set it in Vietnam, but at the
yes.
time it was fantastically
sure.
powerful.
But, you know, I think one of the great things about Boheme is that, and it certainly works updated, but you don't need to.
I mean, I was going to ask about that. So you're just doing it straight,
we're doing it straight because he tells the story so well. And in the same way that it just resonates because, you know, there are still artists who are still starving, trying to make it. People fall in love, and the story is told so succinctly that if you want to do that, I think it's fine. And I know, Allison, you've done an updated production before.
Yes.
And,
oh, yes.
Yeah.
Sounds ominous.
No, but it works fine. But I just simply don't think it needs it. And sometimes the best way to do something, you know, you can be too clever by half.
Yes.
You tell the story, you do it as honestly as you can, and you get out of the way. And I think Boheme is an opera that really lends itself, particularly when you have really wonderful singing actors. And like this last act with Noah as Rodolfo and Allison as Mimi, you believe it. You really believe it. And I think that's the wisest thing to do with this opera.
How do you do costumes for something like that where, you know, it's, again, it's the 19th century, it's 1830, but everybody's poor?
I think we've done a pretty good job, I think generally the one who they make the most sort of scary is Colina. He sort of looks like Fagin in
in
Oliver or something.
He's always covered in this long
yeah.
beard.
Well, let's see,
yeah.
Well, Mimi does, before we get to the total end of it, she does have a wealthy suitor.
Right.
The,
yes.
An act that was written but then never set with the Viscount and all of that. And so she's been taken care of. We don't see it. And the whole thing with jealousy makes a little more sense with that. Yeah, but... Yeah. And Musetta's done all right by herself, you know, with some singing lessons
yes.
and things like that. So.
She numerous suitors.
she gets around. So is it a particular – I mean, this happens in opera all the time, I realize, Allison, but to have to be dying when you sing, how do you pull that off?
Oh, I mean, from a purely technical standpoint, as long as my torso and neck are – aligned. I can be standing on my head. I can be lying down
really?
On my side, you know, doing whatever, and I'll be able to sing. It's just if you're like totally contorted that it would make it difficult. But no, I've done Mimi quite a bit, and one of the most important staging rehearsals is Act 4 and the positioning of the pillows in the bed.
Right.
Uh-huh. So that
right.
once Rodolfo, so usually he picks her up and lays her into the bed, there's a little whisper to whoever your tenor is. He's like, can you lift up the back pillow a little bit? And then, I can die gracefully and comfortably and still sing.
There must be plenty of stories about little mishaps
yes.
like that.
Oh, and you know, the Caruso was a famous practical joker. I don't particularly like practical jokes.
Well, they can be pretty dangerous on stage.
They're dangerous and they're not very funny. But he did a famous one to Geraldine Farrar at the Met. In a performance of La Boheme, he put a salami into the muff.
And to go back to Diana Soviero, she told me, because we were working on this mm-hmm. at the Met, she was coaching me, and she said, oh, darling, do you know what they did? They put the dead fish into my muff.
Oh, right.
And she said, so she's there. I mean, at least, you know, she's dying,
right.
so she really can't react. At least
right,
the boys
right,
could,
right.
you know, do
exactly.
something.
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact,
gives new meaning to carpe diem.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
You get bonus well, points
that's
for
that's
that.
That's even worse. But apparently Geraldine Farrar puts her hands in this, and there's this big white salami. She goes, oh, come bello e morbido. Oh, how nice and soft.
Yes.
Well, we hope that you have some fun with this, but maybe not that to that extent.
Right. And no, we won't do that.
But of course, anybody in the audience is going to be watching very closely.
That's
now.
Right.
And
that's
see,
right.
Okay, are they putting one over on her right now? Did you have to practice then these arias lying down?
No, I mean, when I practice them, I go to my teachers and my coaches and I practice them standing up. But the real practice comes when you're in the staging process. I feel like you can only do so much preparation in a studio. You've got to, as they say, get it on its feet and on the stage.
And in
that's
costume.
What this, yeah, and in the costume. And that's what these rehearsals are for, to, you know, figure it all out. Because it's very different singing in a practice studio than it is singing on the stage and with the orchestra and with your colleagues.
And with several thousand people watching.
Right.
Which is what the way it's going to be. Coming Friday, and it is, let's see, is that
a next
week,
Friday.
A week from Friday. Yeah, right, a week from Friday, May 9th, 7:30 p.m., Eline Hall, and Sunday, May 11th at 2:30, Eline Hall, Marcus Center for the Performing Arts in Milwaukee. And my guest today, principals involved in this Florentine opera production of Puccini's La Bohème, the conductor Joseph Rossinio, and the part of Mimi played by Alison Cambridge, and then the general director, William Florescu.